You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
3, 2, 1...
But I've worked it out. I love to listen to your podcast.
Whenever you say something, other people react to it.
Taking my breath away, Aaron.
Vern Lundquist joins me. Hall of Famer Jim Calhoun. NASCAR icon Dale Earnhardt Jr. Kirk Herbstreit is on the phone.
Welcome in,
here,
episode 3.
We.
The Air Tour Sports Podcast. It is Monday, May 10th. 2021, people, hope everybody had a great weekend. Hope everybody had an incredible Mother's Day. Hope whatever it is, the special lady in your life, your wife, your mom, your daughter, your sister, whoever. Hope whatever it is that she likes to do, she got to do. Hope at the very least you got to make a phone call, got to give a hug. However you spent the day, I hope you have a great Mother's Day weekend. And oh, by the way, you know what's a great gift for mom? A new episode of the Aaron Torres Podcast. A lot to get into today's show. We will talk about the long-awaited Kentucky basketball staff shakeup coming off one of the worst seasons in program history. John Calipari had to get the staff right this offseason. He has done it. Finally, officially hires two of the elite assistant coaches in all of college basketball, Chin Coleman and Orlando Antigua. They were introduced. They did a press conference. We will talk about that. From there, we will transition to some football, Jimbo Fisher versus Nick Saban. On top of that, and this is scary, Nick Saban picked up his second marquee transfer commit of the last couple weeks. I'm starting to worry now as Nick Saban gets more comfortable with this transfer portal stuff. Alabama is only going to go to another level year after year after year after year. And then finally, we will wrap with a story that I've talked about quite a bit. The University of Hartford coming off the school's first ever NCAA tournament berth. I told you 2 or 3 weeks ago they were considering a move to Division III. It has now become official. Let me tell you, I hate it. And not only do I hate it, but it is backed up by facts that this is actually the wrong decision for the school. So we will discuss that to wrap the show. All right, so let's get into the topic of the day, which frankly I believe is really not just the topic of the day, but really the topic of the last 2, 3, 4 weeks in college basketball. We have been talking about a potential staff shakeup at the University of Kentucky basically since the season ended, but really the last 2, 2.5, 3 weeks is when things have heightened as two assistant coaching spots have opened. Joel Justice leaves to become the associate head coach at Arizona State. Tony Barbie takes the head coaching job at Central Michigan. You knew John Calipari was going to swing for the fences with these coaching hires. And oh, by the way, he didn't just do that. He hit a grand slam. As two of the elite assistant coaches in college basketball, Chin Coleman and Orlando Antigua, both from the University of Illinois, are now headed to Kentucky to spearhead the rebuild of Kentucky basketball. And before we get into all the details and this and blah, 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 let me just say this. Let me just say one thing. Say what you want about John Calipari. He is the $8, $9, $10 million man, and there is no excuse for what happened last year. But what I would also say is in an offseason where he has already addressed the roster with a bunch of shooting, a bunch of transfers, really upgraded the talent on the roster, this is about the most gangster move that he's made in his entire coaching career at Kentucky, at least off the court. It doesn't top winning a national championship. It doesn't top winning SEC tournament championships. It doesn't top having three number one overall picks, Karl Anthony Towns, Anthony Davis, and John Wall. But to coming off one of the worst seasons in program history, go out and get the two best assistant coaches off maybe the best staff in college basketball, that's about as gangster as it gets. So shout out to John Calipari. But let's get into the background because I think a few different things here are important. And I think the first one is pretty simple. If you've watched the University of Kentucky over the last couple years, one thing is apparent. the talent level that that program had three, four, five, 6 years ago, not even three, let's say eight, nine, 10 years ago, it has not been the same at Kentucky over the last three, four, 5 years. That directly correlates, by the way, to the fact that there was a major coaching staff shakeup about 7 years ago when Orlando Antigua, who was John Calipari's right-hand man during the glory days of the University of Kentucky run under Calipari, Orlando Antigua left the program in 2014 to become the head coach at the University of South Florida. It doesn't work out there as a head coach. He then goes to the University of Illinois and helps build that program back up. But if you've watched Kentucky over the last four, five, 6 years, the caliber of player on that roster just has not been the same at the University of Kentucky. Go back to the early Calipari era. You had John Wall. You had DeMarcus Cousins. You had Eric Bledsoe. You had Anthony Davis, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, Karl Anthony Towns, on and on and on and on and on. And you just haven't had the same caliber of player. Now, you've had a good player here, a great player there, a player that becomes a great player in the program like Emmanuel Quickley. But John Calipari, when he got to Kentucky, the entire premise of what he was going to do was centered around one thing. He was going to recruit the best of the best high school players in the country and then figure it out from there. And John Calipari's system only works when you have a John Wall, a DeMarcus Cousins, an Anthony Davis, a Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. When you have the number one player in America, it's a lot different than having the number 16 player in America as the signature player in your recruiting class. I've talked about it before. There's a difference between the number one pick in the NBA draft and the number 11 pick in the NBA draft. When you have the number one pick in the NBA draft, you got to get it right. You got to get a franchise-changing superstar, whether it is Zion, Ben Simmons, Anthony Davis, even Anthony Edwards. I was critical of Anthony Edwards. He's been awesome in the NBA. Well, same with college basketball. The difference between signing the number one player in America and building around him and the number 11 player in America and building around him is a lot different. And unfortunately, really since Orlando Antigua left this program, Kentucky has not gotten those same players. And so with John Calipari, what I want to say, and then I'll get into some more of the details from this weekend, is there was really coming off this year only one move that he could make to appease the fan base. Sure, you can sign this recruit or this transfer or this or this that, but it was clear that the entire foundation of what he built and what he had done, how he had built Kentucky, the entire foundation had cracked. You're no longer getting those elite players. You're no longer building around them. And in some cases, you were getting two, three, four elite players in a high school class. That hadn't happened. And so when the season ended, there was really only one move that John Calipari could make that would truly appease the entire fan base, and that was going out and getting Orlando Antigua, his right-hand man, the guy that brought him so many great players, helped him recruit. I don't want to say brought, because that implies that John Calipari didn't do any of the work himself and that nobody else on the staff was recruiting with Orlando Antigua, which simply isn't true. But Orlando Antigua was the point person for most of the marquee players of the early John Calipari era, and the only thing John Calipari could do was go out and get Orlando Antigua. That was the only thing he could do to appease the entire fan base, to get them happy, to get them back on his side, to get him believing that he was going to do what it took to fix this program. And so credit to John Calipari, because not only did he do that, he went out and got the second best assistant coach at Illinois, Chin Coleman, who is an elite recruiter in his own right. You pair those two with Jay Lucas, who was an elite recruiter at Texas, who was on the staff this past season. And I'm just telling you, Kentucky just put together probably the best coaching staff in college basketball. An argument could be made for Chris Beard's new staff at Texas, which has two former head coaches on it. But this was John Calipari. What I call it is his death row records moment, okay? Death row records, you can Google it if you're under 30, but essentially in the mid-90s, there was a record company called Death Row Records, Suge Knight. He went out and signed all the top rappers, and he said, look, we are coming for you, okay? And that's basically what John Calipari did this offseason, because you look at the coaching staff that's now in place. You have an elite recruiter in Orlando Antigua, whose specialty is New York, New Jersey, Karl Anthony Towns, why am I blanking? Michael Kidd-Gilchrist on this Illinois team, Andre Curbelo and Kofi Coburn. You have Chin Coleman, who recruited Io DeSumo to Illinois, very plugged in Chicago. You have Jay Lucas, very plugged in at Texas, helped Greg Brown end up at University of Texas. And so this is John Calipari's death row records moment of like, hey, from New York to Texas, we basically got the entire country covered. Any top player we are going to go after, I am going to come in and close, but I am unleashing my bulldogs on the recruiting trail this offseason. So that is why it is huge. That is why it is big. And all of a sudden, there is so much energy back in the University of Kentucky, the program, the hype, the excitement. And I think this is a really fun thing for college basketball, right? Because I've kind of mentioned this loosely. I don't know if I've mentioned it on this show specifically, but college football, we see these kind of landscape-changing things, and we're going to talk about one of them in a minute with the transfer portal. But about 10, 12 years ago in college football, it was facilities, right? Everybody had to have that elite facility with the juice bar and the this and the that and the waterfall, and then everybody had the waterfall. So what's next? Then you start paying for a ton of assistant coaches. Nick Saban, Kirby Smart, whoever, Jim Harbaugh, Ryan, whoever it is, you're paying your coordinator $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million, whatever it takes to help you win. And I feel like we're starting to see that in college basketball now, where all of a sudden the value of assistant coaches is going up. I mentioned the Texas situation where Chris Beard got three elite assistant coaches, really four, one of them being his special assistant. And now John Calipari breaking the bank to upgrade his coaching staff. And I'm really excited about the future of Kentucky basketball. Now, what I will say, first of all, bringing in a bunch of assistant coaches doesn't guarantee anything. And on top of that, what I would also say is that one thing that did concern me, and if you listen to my interview with Jack Pilgrim last week, we talked a lot about this, is the idea of, yes, the entire program was built on recruiting the elite of the elite, the best of the best. And my concern was John Calipari going back in time to a playbook that no longer exists, okay? And this was one of my concerns when these hires was made was, well, it's easy to say, hey, if I go get these two top recruiters, we're going to recruit all the best players in America. Just one problem. All the best players in America don't go to college anymore. Some of them go to the G League. Some of them go the professional route. Some of them, obviously, this new overtime league, which we might talk about here momentarily. But, you go to this overtime league, you have a bunch of options. And on top of that, Anthony Edwards, Ben Simmons, Markel Fultz, they kind of proved you don't need Kentucky. You don't need Duke to become the number one overall pick and a high-caliber NBA draft pick. And so that was one of my concerns. But as we transition into what it now means for the future of Kentucky, let me first say this. I watched the press conferences of Orlando Antigua and Chin Coleman on Saturday morning, and I came away really impressed with their philosophy going forward. Because what I was afraid of was, we're going to hit the ground running and we're going to sign all the top players. And that's just not realistic in 2021. And so what I loved about Orlando Antigua was, he kind of admitted, look, the landscape has changed a lot since I was here from 2009 to 2014. But what we are still going to do is target the top players that we can that truly are interested in coming to college basketball, because this place, Kentucky, still offers an experience that not really many other places do. And yes, there are going to be those families that they don't care about college. They just want to get their kid as much money as soon as they possibly can. And if that's the case, for the record, I, Aaron Torres, don't blame them. I know nobody in basketball, Orlando Antigua, John Calipari blames them. But what Orlando Antigua said was like, look, the G League offers a really cool alternative, but it is just an alternative. And it's funny, right? Mike Boynton has said that on this show. Mike Boynton, the head coach at Oklahoma State who recruited Cade Cunningham. He's like, look, the G League is an alternative. It's a really great alternative for some people, but college is a really great alternative for some people. And I love that Orlando Antigua basically said that in his introductory press conference. He said, look, we're not going to be able to get all of them, but we didn't get all of them before. But the ones that are serious about the educational aspects, starting on the path towards a college degree, and oh, by the way, having a stage that really only Kentucky and a handful of other schools can provide with the not only the facilities, but the games that you play, the stages that you're on, you're playing North Carolina, you're playing Duke in the Champions Classic. We're going to go after those guys, and we're going to try to get those guys, and I believe that they will. On top of that, I should mention, by the way, when I say they're going after those guys, I ain't joking because, oh, by the way, Kentucky, as soon as they signed Chin Coleman and Orlando Antigua to their contracts, they got a bunch of crystal balls for Ty Washington, one of the top high school players left that is uncommitted for next year. So you talk about going after top players, they ain't slowing down right away, got a bunch of crystal ball predictions for one of the top players in high school basketball, Ty Washington. I know others, including my buddy Jack Pilgrim, have suggested they should go after Jaden Hardy, who might just be the best player in this class. I have heard that he is already bound for the G League in a professional pathway, but I only bring it up because it is clear that right away they're hitting the ground running, wasting no time, and there may be a big commitment here in the next week to the University of Kentucky, which should really springboard this staff as they head out on the road in June to start recruiting the class of 2022. So that's kind of the big picture. One last thing that I would say, and it's something that I talked to Jack Pilgrim about as well. I think these coaching staff hires are important for a number of different reasons, most of them being the recruiting stuff that we just talked about. But what I would also say is on top of all that, there is another element as well. And it is kind of, I think, going to bring Kentucky, I think these two coaching staff hires are going to bring Kentucky back to the roots of how John Calipari built this program, not just from the recruiting perspective, the best of the best, all that stuff, but from the family perspective that I do believe has been lacking over the last 2, 3, 4 years. Now, it wasn't as bad when Kenny Payne, the top assistant, was there the last couple years, but this past year, there was clearly a disconnect. And it's really interesting, right? If you listen to this podcast regularly, I talked about this back in, I think it was December. But when you watch Kentucky, one thing that stood out to me, and Jack Pilgrim and I talked about it last week, I don't know how much actual coaching was going on last season behind the scenes outside of John Calipari. And it's no disrespect to the guys that were on that staff because all of them were being pushed into new roles, and maybe they were roles that they weren't comfortable with. But the one thing that I really respected about the Orlando Antigua and Chin Coleman press conferences, they both talked about how important player development relationships, you know, bridging that gap, becoming a family are, right? And that is one thing that I do think was lacking. And one thing that I think not only was lacking from the assistant coaches, but John Calipari as well. Last year, when John Calipari, basically, you watch the Kentucky game, it was Calipari yelling, screaming, yelling, screaming, yelling, screaming. Players come back to the sideline. Nobody, no assistant coach, nobody comes, pats him on the back, tells him it's going to be okay. And so I think what Orlando Antigua specifically will bring is kind of what Jack Pilgrim talked about last week, something that I wrote about throughout the week, and that is the idea that you need a good cop for John Calipari's bad cop. It's something that I believe was lacking last year. It was something that I do believe It just, you watch those games, and it just felt like there was a major disconnect between the coaching staff and the players, and I believe Orlando Antigua will be able to bridge that gap. Chin Coleman will be able to bridge that gap, and you will have more of that family environment. Kentucky, John Calipari, he has what's known as La Familia, which is basically like once you're part of our family, you're always part of our family, and I did feel like that was lacking as well. I love that Orlando Antigua, one of the great things that he did early in his Kentucky career, he was that bridge, he was that good cop to John Calipari's bad cop, and so all I'll say is, I really love these hires, and it doesn't guarantee anything. It doesn't guarantee national championships. It doesn't guarantee SEC championships, but these were the moves that John Calipari had to make to have Kentucky back to where they need to be, and what will be interesting is to see what happens next with this program going forward. As I said, I think we're all expecting a commitment from Ty Washington, one of the top players in high school basketball over the course of the next week, but just a huge, mega, marquee moment in the John Calipari era. And if this thing is going to get back on track with John Calipari as head coach, this was the move that had to be made. All right, I do want to transition very quickly to college football because there was some actually pretty interesting news that happened over the last couple days. It happened kind of right as I was recording Thursday's show, so I did not get to talk about it on Thursday's show. But let me do a little backtrack here before I get into it. But college football, obviously, look, we know kind of how the calendar works. Season's in the fall. National championship is in the January, early to mid-January kind of window. Then you get a few weeks off. Then spring football starts. And really, once spring football starts, it's really kind of crickets until we get to fall camp, until we get to media days in the middle of the summer. However, what is worth noting is under normal circumstances, and we are finally starting to get back to a sense of normalcy, during the springtime, most of these coaches, once spring practice is done, they really spend a lot of late April and into May kind of doing these booster events, right? It's that time of year. The season's over. You don't have access to your players. They're working out. They're taking their finals. They're going home for a few weeks. And so what a lot of these prominent schools do is they send their coaches on the road for caravans to meet with fans, to kind of, you know, lick, if I'm being honest, liquor them up a little bit, get them to pull out that pocketbook and sign a check. I will say, especially in the name, image, likeness era coming. That may be even more important than ever, but we'll save that conversation for another day. But it is talking season. It is that time of year where the coaches are on the road meeting with fans. And we got a very interesting thing that happened at a Texas A&M event at the Houston, I believe it was the Houston Touchdown Club, where Jimbo Fisher was speaking late Wednesday. And again, this kind of happened while I was recording the last podcast, so I didn't get to it last show. But how about this? Texas A&M coming off an incredible year. Jimbo Fisher, to his credit, has done what we thought he would do when he signed that massive contract and came to A&M. 9-4 his first year, 9-5 against the toughest schedule in college football his second year. This past season, for people who forget, they went 10-1, won the Orange Bowl. They were the second best team in the SEC. They were, oh, by the way, the number 5 team in the final college football playoff ranking. Many believe that they should have gotten in over Notre Dame for that 4th playoff spot. And so I bring it all up to say that it's a good spring at College Station. And so Jimbo Fisher was at one of these booster events, and apparently this little old lady asked him a question that has become probably the single biggest talking point in college football, frankly, in the last 2-3 months, probably since the season ended. And that was this. This nice, sweet little old lady asked Jimbo Fisher, "Hey, coach, are you going to beat Nick Saban before he retires?" And again, it was pretty harmless because A&M is coming off a great year. And Jimbo Fisher, and this is what he answered. This is what got everybody riled up. This was Jimbo Fisher's answer to her question. He said, "Oh, we're going to beat his ass when he's there. Don't you worry," Jimbo Fisher said. Crowd goes wild. And I should mention, before we go forward, Jimbo Fisher, of course, worked for Nick Saban as LSU's offensive coordinator during their national championship in the early 2000s. They're really good friends. And he did immediately say right after, although the "we're going to beat his ass" headline stole the show, he did say right after, "Look, I have a ton of respect for Coach Saban, what he does. They are the standard in this league." And if you didn't see it, Nick Saban kind of had a pretty funny response to the whole thing as well. When he was asked about it, he said, somebody asked him, "Hey, coach, what do you think about Coach Fisher saying that he's going to beat your butt?" And Nick Saban said, "What, in golf? In golf? Because in football, I'm not really that worried, but in golf." And so it was kind of this fun back and forth, but obviously it got two huge fan bases really riled up, especially the Alabama side of things. And so I want to break it down. And let me start by saying this. I think that it is great for college football to have content like this, especially this time of year, especially in the SEC, especially involving Alabama, and really involving two of the great fan bases in all of the sport, okay? Now, from Alabama's perspective, if you're a Bama fan, if you're in Tuscaloosa, if you're listening to this show and you Roll Tide, you're wearing that crimson and white, I understand your frustration, right? Because you're like, why is this guy coming after us? We beat his brains in every year since he's gotten there. We've beaten Texas A&M's brains in every year since the first year that Johnny Manziel beat us in Tuscaloosa. Why is he coming after us? And if you're Alabama, you're like, is this just going to be another guy that thinks that he's going to come after our throne and topple us? Because it ain't happening. And in Alabama's fans' defense, they're probably right. You know, through the years, Gus Malzahn has said stuff like this. Brett Bielema at Arkansas has said stuff like this. Kevin Sumlin, we thought, was going to come for Alabama. Mark Richt, Urban Meyer, Will Muschamp, Kirby Smart, Ed Orgeron. And no one has consistently been a team that can elevate their program to consistently compete with and beat Alabama, at least not in the SEC. Obviously, Clemson's a little bit of a different deal out of the ACC. But nobody has really elevated themselves to Alabama's level. And so Alabama fans are like, sit down, little boy. Sit down. Go back into your corner. Why don't you compete with us here once or twice before you get too fired up? But from Texas A&M's perspective, I love it. And so let me explain why. I understand the Bama fans that are frustrated. But first of all, I have no problem with it at all for a couple quick reasons. The first one, like, what exactly is Jimbo Fisher supposed to say, right? You know, this is a booster event. You're trying to get fans fired up. You're trying to get them to renew season tickets. You're trying to get them to donate to the school. You're trying to get them believing that you have the goods, what it's going to take to topple everybody in college football, compete for a national championship. So what exactly is Jimbo Fisher supposed to say? What is he supposed to say? Dolores, I love you, sweetheart. But Nick Saban, Alabama, yeah. We don't really feel that good about that one. Or, Nick Saban, Alabama. I'll be honest. I feel great about 11 games on the schedule next year. Bama ain't it, though. Maybe you should just stay home for that one. Don't even show up. Give the tickets away. Give the tickets to fail. Like, no. He's with his fans. He is fired up. He's trying to get them fired up. And oh, by the way, he's a competitor. What is he supposed to say? They have no shot against Bama? That's not what your fans want to hear at a booster event. So I love that Jimbo Fisher went out and said that. And I would also say this, too, keep in mind, the players see everything on social media. So if you say, oh, you know, Bama, they're a real tough mountain to climb this year, like, your players are going to feed off your energy. So I understand why Jimbo Fisher said what he did. And I would say this for Bama fans, too. I would say this. I think it's actually an incredible compliment. I think both the question and the answer, maybe even more so the question, is a compliment. Because think about it. What is this question ultimately asking? What this question is ultimately asking is, hey, coach, you've been awesome since you got here. You have lived up to the hype. You are worth every penny that we are paying you. And you've basically taken care of everybody like you said you would. Last year, you beat Florida and Dan Mullen. You beat Auburn and Gus Malzahn. You beat LSU and Ed Orgeron. You beat Mac Brown in the Orange Bowl, which I know that A&M fans love because of their history with Mac Brown. Like, you've done it all. There's only one more giant to topple on the way to the top of the mountain. Can you take down Bama for us? And so I think it's a great question because what they're saying is we believe that we're about to get to Bama's level, but we still know that they're a level above us, and they still know we're who they have to go through to actually compete for a national championship, make a playoff berth, whatever. And so I love the question. I love Jimbo Fisher's response, and I love what this did for college football because for 2 or 3 days, it got college football back in the news. It got Texas A&M a great brand that we are all going to watch every Saturday. It got people talking. It got people remembering, hey, wait a second now. A&M was really good. They were only a half a step behind Bama last year. Maybe one or two more steps based on what the actual result on the field was. But, hey, they're not that far off, and they're coming. And all of a sudden, everybody's talking about it. Then Nick Saban's got to respond. And it became a great back-and-forth thing. I was sitting there watching, working out on Friday morning. Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman are talking about it on First Take. You know what it takes to get those guys to talk college football ever, let alone in the middle of the spring? So I love it. Shout out to the old lady who asked that question. Shout out to Jimbo Fisher. It is good for A&M. It is good for Bama. Gets them fired up. They got some bulletin board material. And oh, by the way, it is good for college football to get people talking about this great, great, great sport in the middle of the spring. Oh, there is one other, by the way, there is one other college football topic I do want to talk about as we begin to wrap up the show. It does have to do with Alabama, nothing to do with Jimbo Fisher, but fascinating nonetheless. And before I get into it, a little bit of a backdrop, backstory, whatever you will, on the Aaron Torres podcast, this show, what I do. As a general rule, I do not talk a ton of high school football recruiting on this podcast, and it is for one simple reason, really. It is because of the fact that the number of guys who step into college football right after high school and have an immediate impact, there's just not very many guys. Now, yes, there's a Trevor Lawrence, there's an Adrian Peterson, there's a Reggie Bush. There are guys that that happens to, but for the most part, college football is dominated by the names that we know. The guys that are returning as sophomores, juniors, seniors, the Joe Burrows, this year Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, Kyler Murray. Like, as great as Justin Fields was the last 2 years at Ohio State, didn't even play at Georgia as a freshman. And that might be more of a Kirby Smart thing, but the point remains, high school players do not have a major impact on college football, and so I don't really talk about them on this show. But I do talk a lot of transfer portal, specifically as it pertains to college basketball, and there was a mega piece of news out of the transfer portal in college football that I think needs to be addressed. And frankly, if we're being perfectly honest, I believe it signals a sea change in the entire sport of college football as we know it. That news is this. Over the weekend, Henry To'oto'o, who played his last 2 years at the University of Tennessee, transferred after Jeremy Pruitt was fired. He was one of the best linebackers in the SEC over the last 2 years, a very good player, former freshman All-American. He announced that he has committed to the University of Alabama to play next season as a transfer. This, of course, on top of the news that Alabama received a commitment from Ohio State wide receiver Jameson Williams over the last couple weeks, and it means now that Nick Saban and Alabama have recruited two elite transfers in the last 2 weeks. And that is scary to me because what it says to me is this. Nick Saban is finally all in on the transfer portal and bought in to the value of the transfer portal to his program and as it pertains to not only Alabama, but the elite programs in college football, the Ohio States, the Oklahomas, the Clemsons, now Alabama, LSU in certain years. the idea that they can come out of spring with a team that's already good enough to win a national championship and then, oh, by the way, say, hey, we have 1, 2, 3 holes to fill and then go into the transfer portal and immediately be able to fill them, that is terrifying to me. And so you talk about a mega sea change in college football. It is the idea that all of these elite programs now can have plug-and-play guys at key positions of need, and they can do it via the transfer portal, and the good teams are only about to get better. You have been warned, college football fans. Now let's talk about Toto specifically, because he is a really special player. As I mentioned, just finished his second year at Tennessee last year. First year, he was a freshman All-American, and when you watched him on Saturdays, this guy was basically a do-it-all linebacker for the Tennessee Vols. I would argue the best player on his defense. I would argue one of the 2 or 3 linebackers that stood out in all of college football last year. I don't claim to be breaking down film like Kirk Herbstreit or Joel Klatt or Cole Kublik, but when you turn on a Tennessee game on a Saturday, this guy stood out, led the team in tackles this year with 76, 10 tackles for loss, and in Tennessee's biggest games, or what against at least the best opponents, I don't know if Tennessee had any big games this year because they stunk so bad, Toto was great. 11 tackles versus Georgia, 13 tackles versus Texas A&M. He was, again, one of the best linebackers in college football last year. And so the idea that he now enters the portal, he now goes to Alabama, and he now goes to Alabama needing a linebacker exactly of his caliber, like I said, it's terrifying to me and to everybody else in college football. And what's really interesting is, again, I've talked about the transfer stuff a bunch from the basketball perspective, but from the football perspective, it's a lot of the same issues. And it's really funny because you know who actually talked about it a lot this spring? Was Nick Saban himself. And he said, look, I don't even like this rule. I don't like it at all. And it's for a lot of the same reasons that I don't like it. I think it's okay for a young person to struggle. I think it's okay for them to overcome adversity. You look at all the great players in Alabama history, I guarantee there was a moment in time where some of them wanted to transfer. Najee Harris, who was a first-round pick this year, admitted during draft season, he thought about transferring during his freshman year. I've talked to John Calipari about it in previous years. Every player that has come through that Kentucky program has hit a wall. John Wall, Willie Cauley-Stein, DeMarcus Cousins, you name it, where they thought they weren't good enough, they couldn't compete, and they wanted to leave. Now with the one-time transfer rule, it makes it easier. Not saying that every player will leave, every player will transfer. And oh, by the way, again, not saying that there aren't good reasons to transfer, but Nick Saban has come out and said, like, look, I don't like this rule. But what was also interesting, if you watched Alabama's spring game, they talked about it. Kirk Herbstreit and Joey Galloway were on the call of that game. And Nick Saban basically said, look, I don't like the rule, but let's be honest. I think it's actually going to help us because we're going to be able to keep our best players. And then again, when we have a hole, an area of need, we're going to be able to go out and get a guy that we know can play right away. We don't have to plug in a freshman that we're not sure if he's ready. We're going to be able to hit the portal, go get a guy that made an immediate impact. And so what's interesting is I want to read you Nick Saban's quote, because I think this is now officially the summer of the portal in college football, where college football as we know it will never be the same. But this is exactly what Nick Saban said, which is exactly what I just addressed. He said, we're going to adapt to it and make it an advantage for us, Nick Saban said, talking about the transfer portal. I think what's going to happen, as you see often in a lot of leagues, the good players go to a good team and the bad players leave good teams because they're not playing. So is that going to make the rich get richer? I don't know. You can decide that. But we will only look for transfers that are going to help our team get better. So that means we have to have a need for them. They have to be a guy better than the guy that we have is in the program right now at their position. And so, yes, from God's mouth to your ears or whatever, Nick Saban is basically a college football god, and he just said it. We're not going in the transfer portal to get a backup offensive tackle from Troy. What we are doing is we are recruiting the best high school players in America, and we're still going to have the Devontae Smiths, the Patrick Surtains, the Tua Tagovailoas, the Mac Joneses. But oh, by the way, when we do have a hole, when we do go into the transfer portal, it has to be somebody that can come in and that we know can play right away over anybody that we have on the roster. And so again, that has to be scary for the rest of college football. And oh, by the way, it's not just Nick Saban who's doing this. You know who else has been an early adapter to this? Lincoln Riley. You know what he did this offseason? And Tennessee fans, again, you're going to want to cover your ears. I just talked about Henry Toto. Tennessee's best running back. Lincoln Riley lost all his good running backs from last year, went into the portal. Eric Gray, Tennessee's best running back, headed to Oklahoma. Tennessee's starting left tackle, Wanya Morris, headed to Oklahoma. And so you look at Oklahoma, a team that has won about 11 straight Big 12 titles, had some holes, went into the portal, addressed them. Same as Nick Saban, same as Alabama. And you know who else talked about it this offseason? Dabo Swinney, who readily admitted, listen, I've been a little hesitant on this portal stuff, but this is a new era, and we are going to be more aggressive in the portal. And so I just think if you're a college football fan that isn't at one of these elite programs right now that's steamrolling everybody, you got to be absolutely scared. Now, I know what the flip side would be, and I know what a lot of you will say is, oh, well, you know, Torres, well, you know, that's still going to lead to transfers are going to still happen from those programs. They're going to go down. And that is true. But it's like Nick Saban said, we've always had, out of a 25-man recruiting class, we've always had 4, 5, 6 guys transfer out, but those were the bad guys. Those were the guys that weren't good enough to play here, that maybe we misevaluated, maybe there was injuries, maybe there was too much competition, whatever. They were transferring anyway. But now what we get to do is upgrade them with better players. Rather than going and having to wait a full year to replace them on the depth chart, we can go out in the spring and go get a difference maker. And that's what he did with Henry Toutou, and that's what he did with Jameson Williams, who, oh, by the way, they felt like we lose Devontae Smith, we lose Jalen Waddle. Yeah, we still have John Metchie back. We still got a few difference makers at wide receiver. But we need speed. We need athleticism. We need a deep ball threat. And so they go get this kid, Jameson Williams, from Ohio State, who was stuck behind 2 first-rounders last year who decided to return. One of them wasn't eligible for the draft, Garrett Wilson, but Chris Olave, who was Ohio State's top wide receiver, many thought he would leave this year, decides to come back for another year. Jameson Williams leaves. He goes to Alabama. And so now Alabama, 2 weeks ago, coming out of the spring, their 2 biggest needs were a difference-making wide receiver and a difference-making linebacker, and they got both of them. And I know there's other stuff that's factors here. Henry Toutou from the University of Tennessee, as of right now, it is still not official that players can transfer from within the SEC from one school to the other. But that is changing here in a hurry. He will be eligible next year. If Nick Saban wants a rule change, it's getting changed. And so all I am telling you is, college football fans, you have been warned. Nick Saban is in the portal. He's coming for your guys, and you better be ready, because I have talked about the impact of the transfer portal in college basketball, and this is the first time I can remember major, major, major change, major, major, major impact from college football in the transfer portal. All right, last little topic that I do want to get into, and it is something that's kind of frankly near and dear to my heart, okay? And it's funny, right? Because I do a lot of topics on this show that are big, kind of headline, gotta talk about them topics. Kentucky basketball, Alabama football, Texas basketball, Chris Beard, Steve Sarkisian, whatever. Then there are other topics that I just kind of want to talk about because it's important to me. And one of them is a topic that I've talked about quite a bit over the last, I don't know, 2, 3 months, and that's the University of Hartford. And I've talked about them for really good and really bad reasons. And as a background, the University of Hartford is about 10 minutes from where I grew up in the state of Connecticut. And the University of Hartford is a place that I could, a campus that I've been to many times, that I could walk to from the house that I grew up in. It's important to me. And so in March, I got a really cool moment, because for the first time ever, the University of Hartford made the men's NCAA tournament. The fact they got their brains beat in by Baylor is pretty irrelevant. It was still cool to see that school on that stage of the NCAA tournament. Unfortunately, there was news that came out like a week after the NCAA tournament, which wasn't nearly as cool, and that was that the school was planning on moving from D1 to D3, basically saying, we're packing up this D1 thing off of the best moment in school history as a Division I school, which was the making of the NCAA tournament. We are deciding to drop to D3, with the idea being that we're going to save a bunch of money on a bunch of scholarships. And so the reason I'm talking about it is because that was a move that was being considered about 2, 3, 4 weeks ago when I talked about it the first time. Now it is official. As late last week, the University of Hartford announced that they will drop from D1 to D3. And let me just say this. This is a terrible, disastrous, awful decision for the university. And what's most disappointing is that it isn't even based on facts. It'd be one thing if what the University of Hartford was telling us publicly was the truth, but instead it's all lies. We've all seen Elf, the movie Elf, Will Ferrell, something about a throne of lies, a bed of lies, whatever it is. That's the University of Hartford. And I will say, in my defense, I have actually reached out to the school president asking him to do an interview on this podcast. So far, no response back. But as a little bit of a backstory, let me kind of explain what happened, why it happened the way that it did, all that good stuff. As I said, University of Hartford, small school in Connecticut. I don't know what the enrollment is, 3,200, 3,500, 4,000, whatever. And they've been in D1 athletics forever. And I think like a lot of other small athletic departments, you know, they're probably feeling a little bit of a fiscal crunch off of a year in which college athletics was as unprecedented as it's ever been. Any small ticket sales that they could make, they probably didn't make this year. Basically, the state of Connecticut until late in the college basketball season did not have any fans in the stands. And so the athletic department is losing money. I get it. And so throughout the course of, I guess, the last year, the school has been working with a consulting firm. And the consulting firm basically found a very simple conclusion. If you just drop from D1 to D3, you don't have to pay for scholarships, you are going to save about $10 million a year in athletics, and boom, the entire athletic department rubber stamped that decision last week as a decision to drop from D1 to D3. And if it was as simple as that, I would not have a problem with it. There is just one problem, however. It is that that report that you will save $10 million is factually incorrect. And it's also worth noting that this same consulting firm that was hired by the school, they were also the consulting firm that recommended that UAB cancel its football program. And we all know what happened there. They canceled the program. A year later, it's brought back. The school, there's an outrage. Now, UAB has one of the best group of five football programs in America. But my biggest issue with this idea that you're going to save $10 million is that, as I said, it is factually incorrect. And here is why it is factually incorrect. It is because the boosters of the school actually went out and got their own consulting firm that kind of crunched the numbers and kind of saw that the first consulting firm, if we're being honest, was just basically lying, okay? So they just took kind of this idea, this is the number of scholarships, this is how much you'll save, and they didn't factor in a number of other things. They didn't factor in that to leave the conference that they're in, the University of Hartford will have to pay a fee. That's some money that wasn't taken into consideration for the bottom line. Of, oh, you're going to save $9 million. Oh, but you got to pay this much to get out of the conference. You got to pay some fee to get into a new conference in D3. You have to, oh, by the way, every school in D1 gets some share of NCAA tournament revenue money because every conference has a team that gets in, and every conference that has a team that gets in, they split that money with every team in their conference. And so it's not a lot of money, but it is a share of NCAA tournament revenue that was not considered in the bottom line. Oh, by the way, on top of this, and I know this as a UConn fan, what they did not consider, and this is something that isn't tangible, so I do understand where there'd be a little bit of confusion from the first consulting firm's bottom line, is that it is almost certain that donations will go down. And I know this because of the fact that I am a UConn alum. And when UConn left the AAC for the Big East, for its basketball programs, one of the big questions was, why don't you just drop to FCS? Like, you're never going to win a national. You're never going to be Alabama. You're never going to be Clemson. You're never going to be Ohio State. Why don't you just drop to the FCS level? And what UConn found was that when programs have dropped down a level, donations basically plummet. And basically, the plus minus of staying at the FBS level, even if it means you're not going to be super competitive as opposed to dropping down a level, you're going to lose so much money in donations that it's not worth it anyway. And so the University of Hartford did not factor that in when they kind of dropped this number of $9.3 million. They're going to make $9.3 million in year one by dropping to D3. No, you're not, because donations are going to be down and people are not going to donate to a D3 school. On top of that, one last little thing that was kind of interesting from the second consulting firm, which said that, oh, by the way, the entire training staff is paid by a partnership with a local healthcare provider, which basically means you won't have a training staff to start the next year. And so I bring it up because over the course of this research, what they actually found was not only are you not going to save $9 million, but you are going to actually lose close to $3 million a year for about the first 5, 6, 7 years. By year 7, 8, 9, 10, you might start to slowly break even, if not turn a profit. But it is going to be a decade before you break even. And so to me, this is what my frustration is. You're coming off your greatest moment in school history, which, oh, by the way, as I've talked about before, is the single greatest marketing tool you can possibly have for your university. The NCAA tournament. There is no bigger platform for a university than the NCAA tournament. And I know these nerdy academic types don't want to hear it. I know they want to believe that donations to the biology department are going to stay the same no matter what. But the best possible thing a school can do is make a run or make the NCAA tournament, because it brings in school spirit for the alums. It generally leads to an uptick in applications. I mean, look, I talked about it last time. But there are many stories written of how Gonzaga University was basically about to shut its doors until they made the Elite Eight in 1999. Then applications went up like 200%. Now they have one of the best programs in the entire sport of college basketball. I mentioned I'm a UConn alum. There have been studies done. UConn, when Gonzaga lost in the Elite Eight, you know who they lost to? UConn, which won its first national championship last year. Applications through the roof. And so this idea that, first of all, that dropping from D1 to D3 is going to save you money, it's just factually incorrect. But on top of that, I don't understand why these schools and why these school presidents, I don't care if you don't like sports. It's okay. Not everybody has to like everything. But the idea that it is somehow going to help your university to drop to D3, it is factually incorrect, not supported by any data. You're actually going to lose money for a lot of time, for a long period of time. And oh, by the way, the best marketing tool that you have, playing on ESPN 2, 3, 4 times a year, that is now gone. And oh, by the way, if you make an NCAA tournament like you did this year, that is gone as well. And so I'm so frustrated. I'm so disappointed. And I'm telling Greg Woodward, the president of the University of Hartford, you have an open invite to come on the Aaron Torres podcast. And oh, by the way, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I misread a fact. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you have data that isn't available to the public, but you can't keep hiding, because you are changing lives, you are ruining lives, and oh, by the way, there are a lot of frustrated University of Hartford athletes. You know how I know that? Anyone see the highlights from this weekend when the softball team at University of Hartford took black tape and put black tape over the name of the school on their uniform? It is because of the fact that at their entire life as they know it, it's blown up, right? I mean, imagine coming to a school to be a D1 athlete, and a year in, 2 years in, you're told, oh, by the way, your goals of being going to the NCAA tournament, doing this, doing that, they're not going to happen. It's not available to you anymore. So now you come to a school, you come to play for a coach, you have friends, you have a community. Now you got to decide, do I stay and not play at the level that I want? Or do I leave a place that I don't really want to leave? And that is what hundreds of athletes are dealing with at the University of Hartford. Now, this is a 4, 5, 6 year plan where all of the scholarships that are currently available are being honored, but it doesn't change the fact that this is the wrong decision at the wrong time for the wrong school for the wrong reasons. And if it made fiscal sense, I would be okay with it, but it doesn't. Shame on the University of Hartford. Gregory Woodward, you have an open invitation. Come on the Aaron Torres podcast and tell the truth, because you're hiding. You haven't done any media availability. And if you really want the facts out there, and by the way, last thing, because I'm yelling and screaming now. It will be cordial. Greg Woodward, I know you're going to hear me. Somebody's going to send this to you, because the last time I talked about the University of Hartford, it got sent to their office. This will be cordial. I want all the facts to be out there. And if you have facts that are not available to us in the public, I want them out there. And it's going to be cordial, and I'm going to give you a platform to discuss, and I want it to be fair to all parties. But hiding out and refusing to talk to the media is not the answer. He did one like half-baked interview in Connecticut a few weeks ago. It was a disaster, and they basically put a muzzle on him ever since then. So Gregory Woodward, you have an open invitation. I will be cordial. I will be fair. I want both sides of the story presented, but based on the information that I have, this is nonsense. All right, that's it for this episode of the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. Long episode today. I'm all fired up. And again, I hope everybody had a great Mother's Day. Before we get out of here, I want to remind you, please make sure that you are subscribed to the show. We are rocking and rolling all spring long. iTunes, the Podcast Addict app, Podbean, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure that you are subscribed. Make sure to rate and review the show. Go ahead, give us a quick 5 stars. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, all that good stuff. Make sure you're following on social media, @Aaron_Torres, @AaronTorresPod on Instagram, AaronTorresPodcastQuestions@gmail.com, AaronTorresPodcastQuestions@gmail.com. That is all for today's show. Shout out to Torrent Craig. Shout out to Rachel, who hates my voice. I will be back later this week.